10th of May, 1971, part two of the interview with Walter Weissman.
For instance, as the logistics problems throughout Germany got worse and worse, and this was already in the fall and winter of 43, at one time I had six soldiers who did nothing but courier services. And you might have a grown man and two even travel across Germany to bring you six little old gaskets from the IG Farben or from someplace developing a new material for gaskets. So you had the most absurd problems, really, considering the scale of the war that was going on. And I had six soldiers at one time, and they even traveled in teams to make sure one would get there. So we were strictly a development laboratory, so was, of course, material testing, because the division, I call it division, but the directorate that we belonged to under Walter Riedel was the design outfit. It's really become the counterpart here to Heimberg's astronautics. See? Well, the entire gang. Connie Dannenberg was the deputy director of that place.
See?
No. The test area was separated. Heimberg even then had the test area. Yeah. But see, all the people you know over there, Hans Paul, the Dürfte, they were not involved but in that directorate. But we just happened to be two specific branches that we were primarily concerned with. I suspect so.
Well, how about the... So you got in there, you began to get back into operations, let's say, during the month of March, and then in April the Americans came up.
Well, we didn't operate anymore, there was no work. To keep up the front. Oh, yeah. But I had to pay people, I had to feed them and all, in high priority business. This was my business, is just keep them going.
Well, what was it like when the American troops first came in? What were you doing on the day they came in?
We got all things just hanging around.
You got a local bar?
I don't think it was in any way sensational or anything. We saw someone having a leg dangle over a jeep on the side, and I think what impressed us more than anything else was the foolishness that we had tried to fight that sort of army. Just their kitchen overwhelmed us. When we saw the first GIs at breakfast saying, "Oh God, ham and eggs again." And we looked at us, I mean, today I'm fairly well nourished, you know. But we were totally baffled that every GI would have his bedroll. In other words, by comparison. See, I couldn't help comparing this. I was in flight training during the first half of 1941, before the U.S. ever entered the war. And I had to fly for a minimum of 2 hours to be entitled to one egg in 41. Oh, I didn't know that. It must have been a master plot. But, I mean, we couldn't have thinking about what we had gone through. And there was an American army coming in, more or less, almost bringing their houses along. And food, it was staggering. And the GI said, "Yeah, ham and eggs, you know." And we were just staggered by realizing the enormous material in the background of this army and the power. And I think Bob Stavers came within 2 days.
2 days after, was it the major unit of the army came in, or was it
I think it was a sort of a
very fighting
a very
no,
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 not
no.
What we had
what
was
the last German troops back through there.
We didn't have anything
never
to
never
speak of. Because he said this was so far removed from any major highway or anything. By the way, this was only some 5 or so kilometers from Lehesten.
Oh, yeah,
you know, Lehesten is the test stand.
Were you there too?
No. We.
I want to talk to somebody who's there.
Well,
there?
The Albert Tula may have been there. But it was really right in the mountains, in little valleys, and it wouldn't have been anything except for soldiers who just took a powder.
Mm-hmm.
For any major unit to even travel that way would have been a real
tragic. So the Americans have drifted into town.
And I think the first, and I think that first unit was a light anti-aircraft unit in front troop support. That's the only thing I recollect, because they settled down on the soccer ground, and we had our barracks in that same area there, because this was the place in town for any kind of open air activities and everything. And Bob Staver inquired, and he came to, we had a small apartment, and he came to me, introduced himself, and this is our first encounter and discussion.
And what was his position, don't you? All ordnance?
As far as I recollect, he belonged to a so-called, what we used to call Ordnance Tech Intelligence Team. My daughter may not remember, but this was the first piece of chocolate she had in her life from Boston. Oh, my.
Well, what did Faber say? Did he speak German? Did he speak English? Or?
I think we sort of met halfway. He had a list of quite a few names at that time. I didn't ask many questions where he might have received this list, but he seemed to know a lot more about us. It might have even been that at that time there had been contacts made, because in a sense he knew more about our various locations and headquarters after the relocation than I was aware of, since we had really been completely...
Well, what's interesting for us to find a date, what, when did you happen to remember when in April Faber came in? To your area, we had to trace him back where he was before that.
Fred, the closest I would say to pinpoint it is between April 10 and 15. I feel that the combat troops, for some crazy reason, that date sticks to my mind, came on April 13th. And I know that Stable was on the heels of those troops. He had just his driver and the jeep, and he was just circulating around. But there were no particular contacts made. The only thing that I assured was that we, for whatever material and people we had the, at least attention, if not protection, of the American Army. That whatever happened after that, no one would confiscate material in some wave of enthusiasm. Or,
how long did he stay with you, Slater?
He left that same day.
The only contact you had with him was come back.
No?
Never did. Mm-hmm. And you had any other interrogation?
Well, we had later on something where both Riedel, Walter Riedel, and I forget the third man, and I, we were interrogated by a team, and it was not Ordnance Tech Intelligence. It could be whether it was CIC or CID. That got rough because Riedel lost some teeth and ended up with a kidney problem. We have been accused by some prominent German citizens living in that place, and two of these citizens were actors, and rather prominent actors, of having made bacteria bombs. And what they found were drawings of a valve belonging to the waterfall missile. And of course, to the layman, if you see a shaft of a valve, you could also say, you forget the dimensions and everything, this is a bomb, depending on how far your imagination wants to go. And we were simply arrested, put in front of the jeep with Tommy guns behind us, and taken up to the castle for interrogation. And Riedel happened to be the boss, probably caught the worst of it. And we were able to convince these guys that they finally, after great serious problems, that they should check with higher headquarters, which then ended up a couple of days later in a complete reversal of attitude and everything. But I think the mood, which one can understand at the end of such a war, would have been to shoot us on the spot. Especially when these prominent people, including the manager or leader of that castle, two elderly ladies, would have sworn in any back of religious book that we were the one. No, Dave, I feel at that time, people might just be panicky and think they play it safe or do the Allies a big favor. It's hard to, under pressure, to figure. I've read too much since to have any grudges. Maybe at that time I felt differently, but you learn and you're absolutely not sure about your own position. You may do some weird things. But it was really probably the only truly unpleasant encounter I've ever had with the American Army. And I didn't know what a nightclub bouncer was, but later on I realized those were the guys that simply had slipped into this profession, because they would just hold you against the wall like this and say, come clean, son, and all this sort of thing.
I'm on a
and after. No, in Leutenberg.
Did you say Leutenberg for long after this?
Well, we stayed, and of course at that time the first refugees in May, specifically, the refugees from the east started to trickle in, because Leutenberg in the state of Thuringia is about 10 miles north of the Bavarian border. So this is a peculiar location in terms of refugees coming through. And we had numerous reports of bringing rumors that the Russians were supposed to occupy yet another zone of Germany coming west. And probably in regard to our relation to the American Army, it would be interesting to know that when I, in my short time here, a limited English, try to convince the army authorities in the next county seat, Zalta, that something ought to be done, more or less saying, look, we risk our necks to bring this stuff out if the Russians are coming. Either these men were really ignorant of this potential threat, or simply, as one man or several even said, ah, you Germans are always concerned, why don't you forget this whole mess, don't you realize we're all allies, meaning of course Russians and Americans, only to be faced with a cold-blooded fact around the 22nd or 23rd of June that the same group had to come and give us a special train, restrict us to 100 pounds of personal belongings per person, and leaving the entire laboratory to the Russians.
Well, that was all lost.
Whether they cleaned out, we don't know. We know that we barely got out. Remember, the cutoff date was June 25 when the Russians came.
So that was the cutoff date. That's a good date.
Cutoff date. And we barely got out. And you can see the mood in our place. We had really risked everything.
Well, how important documents were these for this?
This is hard to tell, Fred. I was more concerned about a very pragmatic view.
Yeah.
To keep even the machine tools and whatever there was in the western side, just to get things going again. I don't mean in missiles, but even in the plain everyday economy, lathes,
right,
everything.
But that was all lost, 100%.
And I mean, more or less the question, my God, don't you guys ever give up? And we then ended up...
That's late June, 45.
Yeah.
And then you fellas had to move out. You moved out on a military train.
Yeah. And
where did you go?
Well, the major transport ended up in Waiblingen near Stuttgart. And this was a schoolhouse, three or four stories high. Unfortunately, there was a mattress factory in that city. So what happened is, since there was absolutely no more housing whatsoever available, that we were able to take all of our people into this school and more or less have one or two or three families in a classroom, mattresses on the floor and partitions of some sort, and the kitchen in the cellar. In other words, you can see there was nothing left in your personal belongings, even if we had a little left in Leutenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really then like a refugee camp. And from there, I took my first step to even find out where the other operation was and made contact. And it was there that people like our directors came then with American representatives to interview certain people for the job.
Do you remember who these Americans were?
No.
Did you ever meet Richard Porter? probably know him now.
I know him, but meeting him in a direct relationship, no.
You don't have a name like Colonel Williams or O'Malley? You wouldn't
know. Only name.
Only name. So that, then you joined the group down here at Bristol House?
No, I only visited.
Just visited.
To make sure we knew what we were talking about. We stayed here, and those that did not go to America, where the families went to London, simply went back to whatever home they had left from Whiteland. This was in a sense...
You didn't come over earlier?
Oh, yes.
You did. This the others didn't.
We went to Lantry, but the majority of us went... This was really the last station, so to speak, for these two laboratories.
And how many people from those laboratories actually came over? Roughly, is it?
Probably a relatively high proportion, because we had kept them together. Now, one interesting job, I mean, today I would consider that interesting. At that time it was suicidal. I went around, and I can't possibly remember the man's name, but Lieutenant Colonel from the 70th Division, the Tomahawk Division, never forget it. He and I spent about a week in an old rotten Jeep with this driver, and we searched for people, and we went straight back even into the other line.
And back to the reservoir.
Battle jacket.
You in a battle jacket.
Straight out of Hogan's Heroes, if I ever saw it.
Did you have any luck? Did you find it?
No, we were scouting. We contacted some people. But it was today when I think about it. The old man sitting up front, and I was sitting on the jump seat in back. And we traveled. We ate well. Oh, man.
You
didn't
prove that you come up a lot.
No doubt. Oh, but this was interesting to get right back into this action.
Well, what was it like going into the Russian?
Well, there was still so much confusion that it was pretty hard to tell who was really on first at that time.
You weren't involved at all in the movement of these two?
No. Because when you have two outfits like this and women and children on your neck, you got this problem. Maybe some guys had less problems moving these two. And I had.
Anyway, you ended up at Lanzo and that came with the group.
Yeah. And I left Germany November the 3rd in that group, first group of 55.
Well, I guess that brings us down to the end, but could I ask you a few questions, particularly about things you talked to us the other day at lunch about the settlement figure? Some of these, so any anecdotes, stories about this sort of guy, how important they were to you?
Well, Fred, I probably found out about their work not so much in my direct relationship with them, but I found out later when, for instance, I was involved only once in the incident I mentioned in Amsterdam.
Right.
But later on, when new equipment was coming, even for Friedland, or I heard more about these things in Fort Bliss when we had time to talk about
them.
Now, a man who really knew angles of this was Magnus von Braun. Because he was used frequently by his brother for special missions. And, I mean, I've been in touch with Sigurd through his relationship with von Braun. I see him when I go to Germany and everything. And there is an operator. The man simply knew what to do, enormous mobility, mental agility, and must have had more connections. And frankly, the term book, The Spear, memoir, to me is another eye-opener as to how things needed to be done. You know, he expresses the point that people, when I have said this in the future, so this I was out, I was sacrilegious about it, when I said in some respects air raid could be a blessing. Because look, the old archaic army administration, that would be a definite handicap to us at Penn and Mimmer, even in my first 90 days. There wasn't anything left of that. And the mobility you needed after that to get things done and really create almost a precedent with every action you take. And Speer in his book says that one of the reliefs was when his own ministry was bombed and the fires burned. And I had to bust out. I was sitting on an airplane, and the people looked at me, I just busted out laughing. Because what he says is that it's so useless to have all these papers, when in reality you need minds at work to create new ideas, and just get completely boxed in.
Because of the conditions of war, you have to do something.
Oh, sure. And so suddenly, after the air raid, real young whippersnappers like myself, I was barely 23 then, got into the act and not knowing any different. Must have done some wild things. Yeah. Well, Dave, at first it was not so much a matter of thinking even of where to go outside of Germany. It was probably by pure instinct, after having lived through a dictatorship. My wife and I discussed this at that time, and we were, again I say, we were, I was then not 25, she was 20, and we simply felt that we would much rather, if there was any gamble, and we weren't sure whether we might not be war criminals, having worked on this, that we would much rather be facing whatever we have to face in the West than under another dictatorship, without having any idea really what we meant by it. Was just an instinctive way, maybe, as I said jokingly later, there are people with my name and more or less my way of doing things in the West, but may not be too many reason Texas and all this in the East, you know. So then of course it soon became obvious that there was an interest. As a matter of fact, there are other people who can tell you more, but as far as I recall, there was hardly any so-called allied countries not scouting for people. Oh, they were all over. Yeah, and this is where I know less, because, as I said, I had my hands full there. And it dawned on us then, and we made up our mind, if we had any chance at all, this would be it, because I guess it depended on where you lived, what was left, your perspective of life. Where we lived, there was nothing left. My parents had moved into their 8th habitat at the end of the war. Even the furniture, my father was a real brilliant cabinet maker. Even the furniture he had done for us before we were married had burned before we ever got to our marriage. So, in other words, over a 2 to 3 year period, and there's nothing left, really. And when you then consider something like the Morgenthau Plan, and you face up to this and say, oh, even if it's only half as bad as these plans propose, isn't it ghost of a chance in Germany? So to us, there was not the slightest hesitation to just kiss it all goodbye and move. I don't know how the others really felt. I don't think the real gut feelings are something. I mean, I usually wear mine on my sleeve. It's part of my habit. I never make any bones about true feelings. But to us, it was so obvious, and there's no question that I don't know the rest. Yeah, when you mentioned a man like Figger, I mean, I know him well as probably the prototype of operators that helped. And the help was probably more geared toward the production finally of the V2. I recently, by getting to that part of Speer's book, when he writes, he convinced Hitler and other people that capable people and organizations in industry and business should be given total self-responsibility, no interference on the part of either the party or the military, and take complete task packages, so to speak. And it's surprising the method that the concept that Speer applied, that he outright considered to be American in nature, that created almost an upheaval among old party members for being too progressive. And I feel that people like Figger fitted into this picture, and for that reason got so much done. They were much less hampered. Indeed, there's an interesting comment in Speer's book why he liked Peenemünde. He states outright that he was against the project, but he couldn't help being impressed by the youthful and aggressive attitude of the people from Rome. Yeah. Yeah. But in other words, there is something that dawned on me, why we had some rather unusual people come from industry and business and be, you might say, troubleshooter. Krieger was known as the man who could get you anything. And the famous story, Magnus von Braun, I wrote a play about this, by the way, in Fort Bliss. Over in late 45 when we opened our clubhouse, and we had all the characters in a play. And it was done in form of a conference. I think it's in German. But Magnus might have said enough of that if he saved it. But this was the typical conference, and we brought in all these little idiosyncrasies of these people, like someone turns to Figure and says, hey, we need these high-speed drills. And Figure says, let me see, the last time I saw the Archbishop of Andorra, I traded some good cognac for this sort of metal that's needed for this. And we really reflected how the operations went in this one place. And it was probably, to me, then an eye-opener. Because we had a big laugh. We used this on Christmas Eve of 1945 to open the clubhouse. Lily, they didn't belong. No, I mean, Figure would be the type, even though he was initially arrested, like most people were, but he fell on his feet, and he would wheel and deal. I mean, you can transplant him to the moon, and before you know it, you have a Holiday Inn going. He owns a piece of the action. There's no question about it.
You know where he is?
Oh, yeah. No. He was up to each director. I suspect there were allocations of certain numbers by director, and that each director, the essence of the idea was to take a skeleton crew that would be able to take Peenemünde and start all over.
And 119 is the bare bones.
Well, even there, Tocco cheated. I think he was limited to 100 or something, and he cheated. He never could count, you know. He was very hard up on. And to see how primitive, it was really primitive how we started again. I built a reproduction plant with the two slowest model autolift machines from scratch in Fort Bliss. There was nothing. No one knew anything about documentation, drawing administration. And I had one sergeant who spoke better Spanish than English, and seven or eight enlisted men. This was my outfit, and we built the first reproduction plant from scratch. And had the first drawing administration, started the supply operation. So everyone really started again in the most primitive fashion, from the way he might have had 100 or so people in San Domingo doing it under his leadership.
What was the morale of the people at the first month?
Well, Fred, it would have helped us to know old, good old American slogans and understand the meaning, like take it easy, or the Army slogan, hurry up and wait. We were not ourselves in Fort Bliss. We couldn't understand that the Army was in no hurry. Because
I guess the war was over. You weren't on a set target.
Sure.
7 years.
I mean, Magnus and I, we caught on soon. I mean, we have a talent to level up, you know. And we used to sit, see, the families weren't there.
Yeah.
See? And Magnus and I used to sit and quietly zip our bourbon. And of course, we had our hands full, too, running that clubhouse.
But, Lord,
yeah, I mean, you know. And besides, that clubhouse became such a showpiece that soon General Homer, the crusty old CD of Fort Bliss, had this automatically in his tour for visitors.
Are you
sure? Yes, ma'am.
What did you
have? Oh, I tell you, this was a beaut. We had, a bar. It was all handmade. This outfit in 10 days converted an old set of empty old quarters in our area into a clubhouse. A reading room, a gambling room, a porch screened in, and in the second deal we had a tremendous garden with overhanging roses and what have you. And boy, within a year we had something going for us. We served a 1.5 ounce jigger of good liquor, including setup, for 22 cents, and you can hardly find them. Boy, for a buck, you could be in orbit.
That's more fun to make a picture. So everybody sort of settled out of the bourbon. And
some guys were very uptight about the whole situation, but somehow we felt it was a good time to learn. And one day, James C. Hamill, the commanding officer, that young man came in, and he gave us a tongue lashing in the worst GI language we ever heard. And when he got through, and we were all looking at him, he suddenly says, "Now, you so-and-so," and he used worse language, "this is the way you sound these days." And I think, God damn, if this sort of language continues in this place. But what had happened is, we picked up the lingo from our only contact. Three American officers and 25 tired old enlisted men. In the early months, we had absolutely no contact. So whether it was the triple nun of our supply sergeant from Georgia, who was constantly doing nothing, no place, nowhere fast, and we picked up this sort of English, or the rather vulgar GI term, and old James T. one day laid it on us, and then he had two professors come from the old Texas Western. And I felt like later on I learned about that famous Dizzy Dean statement when the society lady at the end of that famous movie said, "All right, Diz, I see your point. We will continue to teach those children English and you learn in baseball." God. Magnus, of course, was far-ahead in language. Oh, yeah, he was a natural. But I messed around with the border lingo. I picked on my first English. That time was just a kid, man. Gilbert Olin was great.
Interview on the 10th of May with Mr. Schulze, Huntsville, Alabama.
Okay, you started off back in
1935, when I met the first time with Ivor Turnberg, who was interested in had set up a rocket test place called Versuchsplatz. I keep in Versuchsplatz Hannover. And Connie Danberg was working with Turnberg. I didn't know the connection. And then in 1935, when I started college at Bremen, I met again with Turnberg, and at that time, we picked up some small rocket car testing with solid rocket powder and those things. Then after finishing college, I was drafted into the army, and I again lost track of Turnberg. And I joined the group at Kinnaman at the end of 41. When I...
How long were you on before you got to
the... Actually, with the exception of some what we thought work leave, I was all the time in the army. Because I was drafted in 37, the war started in 39, and I had 16 days left.
Where were you in the war?
In Poland, in Belgium, Holland, France. And then I went back to Hanover to my old job at the Hanover, which is a machine factory, and we began design on artillery guns and special weapons. Until around summer 41, and then I had an appendicitis operation, and that was the reason that I didn't go to the Russian war front. And then right after that, I got on all kind of special